Hey, everybody, I'm excited about this week's conversation with Andre Henry, an award-winning musician, writer, and activist, a columnist for Religion News Service, and the author of the newsletter Hope and Hard Pills. He has a new book out entitled All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, Hope and Hard Pills to Swallow About Fighting for Black Lives. It's an amazing conversation with an amazing young man. I'm excited to share this conversation with you coming up next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, everybody, I'm excited to have this brother in the neighborhood to talk about, I think, a pretty damn exciting piece of work. It's called All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, Hope and Hard Pills to Swallow About Fighting for Black Lives. And yes, we're talking about Andre Henry. Hey, man, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's really great having you here. Just to jump right into it, I love it. And folks, I love it when an author from the very beginning just kind of tells you what's up and you don't have to even think about it. So right out of the chute, I'm just going to turn to this page because it's right here in the beginning. Andre wanted you to know, a warning from the author. Brother says, this won't be an easy read. And you took that approach based off a conversation you had with a friend. You note, he said, you don't write a book to express yourself. You write a book because you care about your people. And it is evident from this writing, in addition to where you have positioned yourself publicly, that you give a damn about your people.
I do.
So just to get folks warmed up to what we're about to get into, talk about the warning. Why did you warn us?
Yeah, you know, I wrote that warning partly because I had a group of my friends, a group of my Black friends, reading some of the drafts of this book. And they actually encouraged me to let people know that we were going to be treading through some traumatizing material,
right?
Because we were going to recount and relive some of the viral police killings that we've witnessed over the past few years. And, you know, many of us, we stop watching things like that, right? We
used to,
like, for our own mental health, don't send me the video of whoever the police killed this time or whatever.
Right.
And my story intersects with many of those stories. And I try not to get into the gory details and sensationalize them, but I also do want to give those people that we lost, you know, I felt it was important to also give those events the attention they deserve as well. So, you know, I know it's, for instance, you know, I recount watching Philando Castile bleed to death in his car in front of his daughter and his girlfriend. And, you know, I spent some time there.
Yeah. Yeah.
About what that scene looked like and what it felt like. So I wanted people to know beforehand, because honestly, if you open the book and you said, nope, I'm not doing that again, I would respect it. You know, say, listen, I am not watching that again, or I'm going back to my imagination.
Well, but you actually, it's interesting what you just said, because what I think people will appreciate, you did in words what a lot of people saw with George Floyd. We saw the 9 minutes. We lived through those 9 minutes on video, right? And so you tell those stories to the extent that you get into that narrative. You talk about narrative, when you talk about Castile, for example, you walk them through that time, what that's like. And so it's almost you're sort of watching the bleeding out. You're watching the video. That certainly that part of the video that often gets cut off, and, you know, no one really wants, you know, the networks come and say, well, the next part is so gory, we're just not going to show you, you know, kind of deal. Well, you walk into that. Why was that important?
I felt like there's this delicate balance of not wanting to make that kind of scene pornographic,
right?
But also wanting to humanize what is happening to that person. And someone gave me that advice. They said the way that you do that is by not focusing on what the police are doing to the person, but focusing on that person's experience. And so I'm thinking of the way I told Eric Garner's story, because there was so much that I learned about some of these people by not just looking at what happened to them, but trying to figure out who was this person. And I found out that Eric Garner, that some people saw him as kind of like a neighborhood dad, right?
Yeah.
He was the kind of guy who would break up a fight, which is exactly what he was doing when he was killed. The fact that they were on their way to Buffalo Wild Wings, I thought was very important to put out there so that people would see, man, this is a regular guy. This is a regular guy. And some would even say, seemed like a really good guy, you know?
Right.
And I feel like that's the part that we don't often get in the stories when they appeared on the news. And I wanted for people to be able to really see these people in a more full picture of their humanity.
So Andre, that's important, I think, from the standpoint of your own personal background.
Yeah.
Because it is, I think a lot of people would be surprised to know the intersections of culture that you have in your own background. Tell us a little bit about Andre. And because I'm going to have a comment or two or question around Mr. Guthrie. I think it's important that we start so people know when we get the Guthrie, what we're talking about, because there's a whole lot of Guthries out there that we are all way too familiar with. But give us a little piece of Andre, the young boy, the kid in the family growing up, and it kind of shapes the Andre the man now.
For sure. So I grew up in an immigrant home. My parents are from Jamaica. My grandparents are from Jamaica. Their parents are from Jamaica. You know, we're Jamaican. You know,
you're Jamaican.
There's some Cuban in there. There's some
Cuban.
But you're
Jamaican.
We're pretty much Jamaican.
Jamaican.
Right. So
we all got a little Cuban somewhere, but we are.
So that's a thing, you know. And I grew up in Stone Mountain, Georgia, just a few miles outside Atlanta. And so in the crosshairs of both the legacy of the Confederacy and the Civil Rights Movement, they overlapped there, you know. And somehow my Jamaican grandmother found her home church at this multi-ethnic, I would say, like, is mid, not maybe a little bit, maybe between midsize and mega church, you know,
right.
It's not mega
right.
church, but it's also not small. There's maybe like 1,200-1,500 members at the Assemblies of God Tabernacle in Decatur, Georgia, Assemblies of God Church. And that's where, so there are all these crosshairs, right? Like my home is basically like little Jamaica, you know, my parents planted banana trees in the yard,
right.
And that kind of stuff. So, you know, I literally have a picture of myself in front of one of the plants in my mother's yard that looks like I'm in Montego Bay. You know? So like there's that aspect. And then there's going to school around all my African-American friends who have a different angle on the Black experience.
Right. Right.
And kind of code switching between those two environments. And then I have this multi-ethnic church that is mostly Black and brown in congregation, but entirely led by white people.
Right.
And most of the white people that I knew growing up were at that church. I didn't see many white people
right.
coming through the door of my home or at school. So yeah, all of those things kind of overlapping. And I was very much involved in the church too. I loved, you know, church. So I wanted to be there anytime the doors were open. And that's how... in a very Jamaican way, because we adopt everybody. You know, if you're around, if you're around us enough, then your cousin so-and-so, auntie so-and-so.
That's right. That's right. Right.
And so we adopted, you know, this white family that I met at church who was very kind to me as a boy into our extended family. And I, You know, I grew up calling them brother, sister, you know, even mom and dad, because my mother chose them as godparents for me eventually.
So you have this kind of bicultural experience. Mm-hmm. You know, your Jamaican culture. Now you're in this in white evangelicalism in terms of your religion. Religious experience. Then you've got the South.
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, so folks need to understand, you know, my family's from the South. They're from South Carolina. Mm-hmm. I spent my summers growing up in South Carolina because my mama wanted me to have that experience. And I kept telling her, Mom, it's hot here. I don't need this. It's really too damn hot.
It really is.
And she was like, nah, baby, you need to go spend some time with your aunt on the farm. Ma, I do not want to collect chicken eggs at 6 a.m. But, you know, that's what I did. And so you have all of these three areas of your life kind of intersecting and shaping your early narrative. Mm-hmm. How did that shape this book? What was it that you wanted to capture in this book about that experience so people could better understand when you got to talking about Guthrie and understanding, which we'll get into, the title of the book?
Yes.
You know, all the white friends I couldn't keep.
Yeah.
Because at some point, this journey leads you to a break, metaphorically speaking. But go ahead.
You know, and I want to be brief about this because there's so much that could be said. There's so much.
There's a couch. You can get on it. We can just, you know, we can turn this into a session if you want, brother. I'm good. I got coffee. I'm ready.
There's so much that could be said. And I love that you highlighted growing up in the South, because there are some historical factors that are much broader than the personal factors going on in the South that stem from the Reconstruction period and the period just after the Civil War, where Confederates immediately wanted to reframe what had happened.
Right. What had happened was.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to tell you a different story.
Exactly. So they wanted to completely contradict the papers that were written by Southern governments that said, we want to secede from the Union because y'all trying to take slavery away from us.
Right.
You know, and Confederates immediately wanted to reframe that narrative as a legitimate uprising against government overreach and, in some of their words, even tyranny, much like the recent insurrection that we had in America, right? And so I write in the book that by the time myself and the white friends I couldn't keep inhabited that same land that once held enslaved African people and once absorbed the blood of people fighting to end that institution, that the stage was already set for our miseducation. You know, most of us didn't understand. So you got the white folks that grew up there and they got that revisionist history at school. You have my parents who came from Jamaica and just didn't know that.
Right. History. Right.
Listen, my dad told me the other day that and I remember seeing this as a boy, but I didn't see these details. I remember when we moved into Stone Mountain, we were the only black people we knew. And all the white people started moving out. Our white neighbors moved out. We lived next to a man who claimed to be a part of the Ku Klux Klan, pulled a shotgun on my brother for walking the dog through the neighborhood. I remember that stuff, but what I didn't remember is that my dad told me the other day that they moved in, like as many Jamaicans moved into that area, and all of a sudden Confederate flags started going up all over the place in Decatur. Well, we're all Caribbean, so we don't know what that flag means.
Right.
So we start putting
our some pretty colors.
Yeah, so we start putting our flags up. You see Jamaican flags and Guyanese flags.
Oh, God.
And because the Confederate flag didn't have meaning for my parents in that way. So
right.
I say that to say that I couldn't get the education about American racism from my parents because they didn't understand those dynamics, right? In the same way. They're like, this is a land of opportunity for us. And they didn't know about that. And then I went to the same school as these white people, so I didn't get that education either.
Right.
So that's one factor that I wanted for people to understand, is that there is this miseducation about race, about racial justice, about racial progress, And I didn't even talk about the historical factors of kind of how this language, this rhetoric of colorblindness kind of came into American politics after the civil rights movement, while people were still kind of pursuing the same structural, you know, inequality. So all of that is swirling around in my upbringing, right? But I know that it's not just my story. It's the story of America, right? There's so many of us that have grown up under that same miseducation. And then there's a story of Black identity formation happening in the book for me, where it's like when James Baldwin said he used to be watching those Cowboys and Indian movies and he's cheering for the Cowboys, not realizing that he wouldn't be one of them. In that historical narrative. Well, I kind of started having that because as a boy, I was extremely patriotic, you know, and patriotism, I think, is hard for Black people right now once you start understanding the many ways that, you know, this society kind of, you know, has, to put it mildly, been reluctant to share, full citizenship with us, right? So, but I was very patriotic, and I used to sit in my room as a young boy, 9 or 10 years old, drawing pictures of the Boston Massacre and drawing charts and diagrams of the American Revolution and memorizing the dates and singing "Proud to Be an American." And also,
you were all up in it.
Oh, listen, I was very proud
to be an American.
That was my jam.
I'm free.
That was my jam. And when I started really being able to name some of my experiences of racial profiling, for a long time, white people were able to just tell me, don't play the race card. And that was enough to shut me up and to reconsider, maybe I don't understand my own experience in this world.
Right.
But after living a few years in New York City and having, you know, several, you know, instances of being searched for drugs and weapons, all the stop and frisk policing, and in other parts of the country, you know, where police officers just stop me and they just know this man has drugs and weapons on him. And seeing Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, Rekia Boyd, Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, and you go on, it just became undeniable. And by the time I saw Philando Castile, I said, you know what, enough is enough. I'm tired of pretending that I don't know that this is more likely to happen to me. And I'm tired of feeling powerless about it. So I need to go figure out what our predecessors did. Well, first off, I need to look into more what people mean when they say systemic racism, because I don't really know what that means. Yeah, at the time, I was like, I understand that racism is alive and well, but I don't know what people mean when they say systemic. So that was my first assignment.
Can I just, before you go to the next assignment, why that's important? It is the essence of the bull around critical race theory. Yes. Because I guarantee you the people who are chomping at the bit around critical race theory themselves don't understand what systemic racism looks like, what it means, and how it plays into that narrative. So it's important for you as a young Black man to say, I had to go and understand exactly what that meant.
Yeah.
And how does that move the narrative for you?
Well, I think a part of that is, you know, talking about how me and the white friends I wouldn't be able to keep, and we get to Guthrie because we're on the path.
I told you we're going to get there.
We're on the path to Guthrie right now because none of us really understood that, right? And the thing is, if Black people don't understand that, then we can't even really advocate for ourselves because we don't understand the situation that we're in. Right. And that's the position that I was in, right? I'm sitting here, I know in my heart, and not just like some feeling, but I've experienced these things, right? But I don't have a real analysis of it at the time. I don't really have a real understanding of it at the time. So it's easy for people to kind of swat it away,
right?
Nah, that's not happening, you know?
Yeah.
There's another, and they give me the story that they want for me to believe. So I was like, I got to look into this some more. And what I did was I started reading Bryan Stevenson and Michelle Alexander and, you know, reading about the criminal justice system and learning things that I just would have never learned otherwise. I was just assuming, you know, things work the way they're supposed to be working. And boy, was I in for a rude awakening.
You were, and we all have been at various times. And why I particularly gravitated to your story And while your expression of being a young Black man in this environment today is obviously very different from my expression as a young Black kid at the time growing up in Washington, D.C., and dealing with all of the dynamics of, you know, I mean, the riots took place in my backyard. You know, you're watching all these people come into the neighborhood who, you know, burning stuff up, and cops are out there with dogs, and mama can't take me to the park, and all of this, all of these things, you know, very much like you had that moment with your daddy telling you, you know, okay, this is really what was going on at the time. You know, my mama had that same conversation with me. She's like, baby, you have to understand that, you know, when we went out, took you outside to play, we couldn't go down to the park at the end of the, you know, the other corner of the neighborhood because it was still for white only in the mid 60s. Wow. So there are those dynamics about all of this that you express in this book, and in the way you sort of talk about them in the various chapters, which gets us to Guthrie in The Right to Remain Angry. In that chapter, Guthrie is a tall, stocky, and bald individual with a southern, thick southern accent. He couldn't have been older than 27 at the time, and yet the Stones, you'll tell us who they are in a moment, treated him like drunk uncle from Saturday Night Live, someone always blurting out something problematic, but so hopelessly behind the times and beyond changing, you can only shake your head at him. That moment with Guthrie was important. Tell us who Guthrie is in your life, and why you had this screaming moment in your head when Guthrie's pontificating and you're looking at the room going, do you guys realize that this brother just said what he said? Because it gets us to understand why you conclude as you have that I can't do this. So I cannot have this discussion with white folks about race anymore. So go ahead. Floor is yours, my friend. Guthrie.
Sure. You know. Okay, so let me just frame this a little bit. The thing that I'm doing in the book is saying we got work to do.
Right.
We got work to do. But these white people are trolling us. No, not everybody, but you know, a good enough number of them.
That is noticeable.
it's a notice that they're trying to keep the conversation at the ground floor to where we're always arguing about whether or not racism is even a problem or whether it exists in America. And I think that is a part of the crux of the CRT thing, right? We don't even want to have the conversation about whether or not these dynamics are real. So I went over to the Stones' house, and these are the folks that we were talking about earlier, the white family that we adopted as our extended family. I used to have two Thanksgiving dinners every year, eat with my Jamaican family, then I'd go drive across town and eat with my American, you know, my white American family, my white evangelical family. And so I walk through the door, as is my custom, and, you know, the senior Stones are on the couch reclining and watching TV. And from the kitchen, I can hear the siblings in the kitchen having a lively conversation. And I walk in and they're talking about the Ferguson uprising. And I had assumed, oh, yes, Guthrie is pontificating at this point about how he's dealt with those people, you know, who those people are, us.
Right.
And how, you know, we all just have this criminal instinct inside of us that puts us in these, you know, because he worked in something adjacent to law enforcement. So I'm listening to him, and I just assumed that the lively conversation that was happening before I walked in was my god siblings telling him that, you know, that kind of stuff is not true. Now I can neither confirm nor deny that at this point, because when I actually, and at this time I was very committed to trying to patiently correct white people who spoke like that. And I said to him, you know, like, if you really thought about the history, if you understood the history, then you would understand why sometimes Black people can get so upset about racism that they might break a window or two. They might want to set something on fire. you know. Now, I've never broken any windows or set anything on fire, but I can understand why some people would. Okay. And Guthrie looks me in the face and says, "You need to learn more about the white man's history." And it took everything inside of me. It took everything inside of me not to say, "What the hell did you just say to me?" You know, like, it just took everything inside of me not to go off on him. Because I really wanted to avoid the trope of being the angry black man. But I didn't understand why nobody else in that room said it, had, you know, like, I knew why I didn't. But at the moment, I'm looking around the room and I'm saying, like, do y'all not hear that when he says those things about black people, he's talking about me? Mm-hmm. He's talking about the man that you call your brother. And you have called your brother. We met each other when I was 9 years old. I'm maybe 29 at that moment, right? Mm-hmm. We've been in each other's lives for so long. And there was just no correction. Now, I left Thanksgiving dinner at that point. I'm like, all right, appetite is gone.
Right.
And I think I saw them again the next year. No, I mean, that was in November. So it was like the following spring I saw them again for lunch. And when I got there, one of the senior stones just said, okay, we're just not going to talk about politics at the table. And that was the nail in the coffin for me, because I just couldn't believe that it seemed that the message that they got from that incident was not, okay, Guthrie needs to watch his mouth and not say racist things about our family member.
Right.
But that me talking about the struggles that our people go through is too disruptive for their family.
And that for me has been a part of the black individual's story from day one. Mm-hmm. And we see it reflected today. And I loved, you just expressed it so well, because it's why folks have their draws all up in a knot around 1619 Project.
Absolutely.
It's why they have their draws all up in a knot about critical race theory.
Yes.
It's why they look at what happened to young black men and ask the question, why do they just stop resisting? Why don't they just, you know, because even when they don't resist, they still get shot. Yeah. Okay. So you tell me the scenario in which we won't get shot, and we'll do that.
We'll do that.
Okay. Because so why is it, Andre, that when we decide, and your generation has made a declarative statement, we are going to tell our story?
Yes.
We're not just going to let George Floyd die without filling in the backstory.
Yes. Yes.
And connecting it to a 400-year history.
Mm-hmm.
That white folks get uncomfortable real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And like your family, your white evangelical family said, well, we just not going to talk about that.
Yes.
We'll put it, the euphemism, politics.
Yeah.
We're not going to talk about politics.
Exactly.
Like, that's somehow political. So we're going to have a nice lunch, and you're going to be the good Negro, and we're going to be the good white people, and we just all going to. How do we go at that? How? And that's where you're trying to push us in this book. That's activism. That's the connection. How do you express that? What do you want people to see and how to respond to that?
Oh my gosh. There's so many things I want to say to that.
Just say it, man. We good.
You know what I say to that? Because, you know, and I said this in that chapter, The Personal and the Political, is that I hadn't considered that the reason why this family had me around was because I didn't speak up about that stuff. You know, I hadn't even considered that my presence served a utilitarian function for them, to prove to themselves and to anyone else that they wanted to show me off to, that they are not racist. And that's all they wanted. They just wanted to appear to not be racist, right?
He got a black friend.
Yeah, exactly.
We call him a member of the family.
Exactly.
We have him over at the house at Thanksgiving.
We know his first and last name. We know his mama. We know all the stuff, you know? And so that, I think that's one aspect of it, right? But what I want for people to realize in this book, partly because people, I think, overestimate the power of proximity. Now, I believe in the power of proximity.
Yeah, no, it's value to that.
Yes, but I think we overestimate it because some people think if you just get close enough to each other and you hear each other out and you have a civil conversation about this, a reasonable, rational conversation about this, then that's how we end this thing. And what I learned through this journey was that it almost never had to do with my approach to white people. It had everything to do with the audience's own relationship to their level of knowledge, their openness to the conversation, their willingness to go through a political awakening like I was. And because I realized that some people are just not movable, mm-hmm. It don't matter how close you are, it don't matter how calm you are, it don't matter how well you speak, it don't matter how well you can put the arguments together, how much history you can present to them.
Right.
Some people are just not movable and they have their reasons. It may be that they just don't want to know. It may be that they enjoy their position of privilege and power. It may be a number of things. But you're not going to be able to move them. And so the thing that I'm trying to say to Black people and people of color in this book is we have to build a movement for our own freedom, whether these people like it or not.
There you go.
Whether they agree with us or not, whether they want to participate or not. And that we need to construct our own analysis of our situation without presenting it to them for their approval or agreement, and take the necessary actions that we need to lift ourselves out of the situation, which there are so many approaches, but I believe that one of the approaches that's missing from many of these conversations is the approach of civil resistance, like we saw in the civil rights movement. And that's what I'm pushing for. And I know that we've seen some of that in 2020 with the global uprising.
Right.
But I want to just say to that's good. Right. But I had a conversation with one of the scholars that I mentioned in the book, Erica Chenoweth, whose research revealed the facts about nonviolence, about it being twice effective as armed struggle, about the 3.5% rule, which maybe we'll get to, maybe we won't. And she told me we're losing more battles around the world through nonviolent struggle than we're winning. And it's not because there's something inherently weaker about nonviolent struggle, but it's because we've forgotten the most strategic and most disruptive parts of nonviolent struggle, which are the organized strikes and the boycotts and the
The threat is the threat of violence. So I want to take a quick break because what I want to come back into is the point you're making now to pick up on how is this movement you're talking about different from the movements that we've seen before.
Yeah.
And you've just begun, I think, to open up a little bit of a window on what that difference was.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into that with my buddy Andre Henry in his new book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, right after this.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Michael Steele Podcast. We are having an enlightening conversation with Andre Henry, award-winning musician, writer, activist, and the author of, I think, the profoundly engaging and important book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, Hope and Hard Pills to Swallow, about fighting for Black lives. Andre, before we went to break, we were talking about this idea of the movement, and you express, as you do in the book, this energy around creating a movement that actually begins to push up against this sort of quiet, sort of safe space that a lot of white folks want us to be in and want to create.
Yeah.
So I guess I question that a little bit in the face of the movements that have gone before. Certainly what we know from the 50s and 60s in the civil rights movement, but even movements in the past, the movement to respond to lynching in the country, the movements to respond to, you know, the enslavement of Black people to begin with, which led to the formation of the party I belong to, the Republican Party, out of the Whigs and the Reconstruction period, the Civil War. Also, you had these pressure points in history that kind of create an outcome. How is the movement you're referring to different? Because one element for me, and we were talking about it, is sort of the nonviolent component. What made the nonviolence work in the 1960s was the threat of violence, right? Because if white folks had a choice between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, we go with Dr. King.
Right.
If I have a choice between the Black Panthers and SNCC, we go with SNCC. You know? Yeah. So there's always this kind of Black folks had this way that now we can be the angry Black people if you want,
yeah,
or we can do this. Mm-hmm. And I want to put a pin in that, because I want to come back to the angry. You referenced the angry. You didn't want to be the angry Black man, and I'm here to tell you there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, just so we set the record straight. I'm tired of white folks telling me, oh, you know, you can't be the angry white man, Black man. I'm like, oh, but you can be the asshole white person.
Right.
I digress. I don't want to get there ahead of myself. Yeah. But talk about the movement piece and that balance between violence and nonviolence. And how white folks specifically respond to it, as you noted before, when we burn a building, they go, see, there they go.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they want to say, these people got no home training. They got bad parenting. There's no reason for you to be that angry.
Oh, but hell, we can go and storm the nation's capital and poke out a police officer's eye with a flagpole. Right. That's okay.
Right. But
burn a Target in my neighborhood.
Right, exactly.
Go ahead. The floor is yours, my friend.
Right. And you don't hear any white people saying, look at these thugs burning down their own country. You know, like,
burning down their own country.
About us, you know? You know, I have heard people make the argument that without a radical flank, the threat of nonviolence isn't as potent, you know, and I've heard people make that argument. And I, you know, at a certain point, it's like, that makes sense to me, right?
Right.
The thing that I do notice, though, because, you know, I've been on the streets with activists, I've tried to organize, you know, in my locales and things like that. And the thing that I see two. If you wanted to reduce this, you could reduce this down to two types of people, which I hate making binaries, but for the sake of making the conversation easier, we can do this. You have a group of people, I would say most people, that have a complete miseducation about how civil resistance and nonviolent struggle and social progress works. So they seem to think that Dr. King led a few people into Birmingham by himself, and they just had a few civil discussions with some white racists over coffee, and then he preached, "I Have a Dream" speech. He ascended into heaven, and we all live happily ever after, right?
And then Barack Obama got elected, and we're good.
I mean, we're good. Post-racial society, everything's good, and all we got to do is just keep on talking nice to white people. And, you know, everything will be all right. And that's really what they believe. And when they say nonviolence, they usually mean inaction. And that's their conception of how social progress happens. And they also seem to think that the way that we move forward is if Black people find the worst white racists we can and just hug them into anti-racism. Just hold them and don't let go. until they believe that racism is a problem and they see the light. So that's one.
Right.
That's one factor. Right. And then there's kind of the activist community, right? And I hope that nobody will have my head for this. Y'all know I'm being reductionistic, but from being on the street, there's a lot of people who are very passionate and very active, but haven't really looked into why previous movements worked and how they worked.
Right.
And so there's a lot of passion on the street, but there's not a lot of strategy. In fact, there's a lot of people who are anti-strategy. Now, in my journey, listen, I started reading the dead civil disobedience practitioners. I started with Thoreau and Gandhi and Tulsa
right.
And went down the line. But then I started getting in touch with living revolutionaries. And I pretty much just bothered them until they understood, I'm your friend now. I'm your student now. So, you know, I'm gonna get this information. And one of my mentors I'm thinking of right now is Serge Popovic. She started the movement that overthrew Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia.
Yeah.
And he said, he has a saying. He says there are two types of revolutions. Spontaneous and successful.
Yeah.
And
that's a very interesting point.
And basically what we've seen in civil resistance struggles around the world is that the more that people take a militant approach to strategizing, which means getting all the details of that conflict situation, including the geography and the culture of the people and the way the political system works and what laws apply to you and how many security forces are there, how long does it take to get from point A to point B, and doing that kind of work and structuring that movement, that has always exponentially helped contribute to movement success.
Right.
And that's the work that seems to be being overlooked in many of our movements today. And I saw it firsthand on the street. I can't tell you. Just one quick example.
Sure,
I remember being with a group of activists, and we had just called ourselves doing an occupation of City Hall the night before. We got chased off the premises because the local police shot a Black man in the back. Mm-hmm. We were running away from them, and the police shot him in the back. And so we're occupying City Hall, which we ain't had no business doing, first off, because we ain't had no plan, you know. But
right. I'm in the neighborhood. Let's go. Let's do it.
You know, I'll be the squeaky wheel. Nobody listening to me. But you know what? You're not going to get roughed up by yourself. So I'll go, you know, I'll go spend the night. All right. We got chased off the premises. Next morning, one of the leaders is like, OK, we're going to march down to the mayor's house and we're going to tell him to fire the police chief. And I said, OK, but why would we do that? Because in this city, the city manager is the one who hires and fires the police chief. So why would we march down to the mayor's house when the mayor doesn't have the power to do that, right? Now, we could have avoided all this non-strategic activity the whole week, occupying the city hall without a plan, talking about me going down to somebody's house and telling them to do something they don't have the power to do, if we would have done like our predecessors did in the civil rights movement before Dr. King, the SCLC, and them ever stepped into Birmingham. They spent 4 months in Savannah, Georgia, getting all that information together and planning out that campaign. And that's partly why it was so successful. But that's the work that a lot of people don't want to do these days. And so that's really what I'm pushing for in the book.
So do you find it to be more reactive than anything else? I mean, I think the only, in recent times, the only one that not only started out maybe reactive, George Floyd, in the response to that, but then seemingly turned into something more than just a reaction, was how this became sort of a global moment around his killing. You write that racism won't be resolved through civil discourse, diversity hires, interracial relationships, or education. And I would further infer from that the kinds of reactive responses that we see. What instead do you think is needed then? How do we take that old school civil rights preparation and planning and update it to the moment? Because, you know, Martin Luther King didn't have this. He didn't have a cell phone that, you know, oh my God, did you see what just came across on Twitter? Oh shit, what the hell? Oh, where's Andre? You know? And next thing you know, 10 minutes later, you're all standing out there on city council, in front of the city council.
Right.
How do we make that transition?
Absolutely.
To effective protest?
This is such a great question. And I do think that a whole lot of this has to do with more political education around why social movements in the past have worked and what they did, which we saw in Serbia as well. I'll bring that up again, is that when they trained activists, they literally took them through the dynamics of nonviolent struggle, why it works, how it works, how power works. That's incredibly important to know. And so, like you've already kind of covered, bringing in the preparation part, the analysis part, right? Mm-hmm. That's helpful. But what we have oftentimes is that people go straight to the tactical level, right?
Right.
So the right. first thing that they do is go, okay, we're going to go do a march. We're going right. to go do a rally. We're going to do, but why?
Where's Reverend Sharpton?
Right.
Let's go. All right.
Why and how are you choosing those tactics?
Right.
And that's what the analysis part is supposed to help you decide on what tactics would be useful, right? Strategy helps us to determine the timing, targets, and tactics that we're going to use, right?
Right.
So with that example that I used about us marching down to the mayor's house when the mayor can't even make that decision, is if we had actually taken the time to analyze the situation, then we would have chosen the right person. We would have chosen the right place to show up. And we would have had an idea of what kinds of actions would actually put pressure on that person. Mm-hmm. For instance, I'm thinking of the activists in Syria that wanted to pressure the dictator. I can't remember the name right now. I think it was Assad, to step down. Mm-hmm. And what they had to do was analyze the situation and realize that the closest that they could get to Assad was one of his buddies who owned a hotel chain there that attracted a lot of tourists.
Right.
So, okay, now we know how power is moving through this system. We may not be able to actually get to Assad himself, but if we can get these folks to stop buying hotel rooms from his buddy, we can start draining the dictatorship of the resources that it needs to put down protests and putting pressure on him. And that's exactly what they did. So when we actually invest in the analysis and the training and the preparation phase of doing these movements, then the right tactics will present itself to us, because then we won't just be assuming that if we get a bunch of people out in the street and chant defund the police enough, that it'll happen. That's not how it works.
Right. Know? No. But why that's important is you see it being played out. What do people think Joe Biden is doing with Russia right now? Yeah. He's figuring out tactically, let's go to the, okay, forget Putin. Let's go to the oligarchs. Exactly. Let's go after them. Let's go after the people who are sitting at the dinner table with Putin.
Right.
So
and that's exactly what we mean by a militant approach to nonviolence, right? So there, that what you're seeing is a strategic conventional military approach to putting pressure on Putin, right? And we have to adopt a similar militant approach to nonviolence. We're just not using weapons, right?
Right. Right. And that brings us I could talk to you for hours, but I know I gotta let this brother go on and sell his book and get back out there on the streets and educate America. But it was very interesting to me as you set this story in place and you talk about, essentially, I got to disengage from trying to convince white people about mm-hmm. racism. You get to this chapter about Black love.
Yeah.
How Black love became important to me. And then I'll be honest with you, as I'm reading through this, and I'm coming out of, you know, building our own tables, and I'm talking about all this other stuff. And then all of a sudden I was like, like a Scooby-Doo moment. It's like, okay, what's love got to do with anything? Where the hell is this brother going? You know, by the time I moved back to Los Angeles, I had grown skeptical about the podcast. What the hell? We having a moment here? So how does that connect into this? I gotta understand where the brother's coming from here.
Well, Michael,
how does that connect into your story?
There are so many reasons why, but one thing, and I'm just be really honest about it, is that there is a dynamic to this where, as a Black man speaking about this, that I knew that people are going to check and see, okay, but who's his partner, though?
Yeah, okay.
Right.
I mean, what's going on?
Right. There is a bit of that, right? Because there is a part of this where people feel like, if you're really serious about this, if you're really down, then you will love a Black woman. You'll be with a Black woman, right? So I knew that I couldn't talk about Black liberation without talking about Black love. And it's funny because one of my editors, in the proposal, he was like, I don't think you need this chapter. First off, this chapter could be a whole book on its own.
Right.
And secondly, like, what does it have to do with anything? And I was like,
that was my thought as I began reading.
Yeah. Yeah. But I was like, I mean, you got to understand, though, that there are a lot of Black women that are going to say, this conversation is incomplete if you don't talk about this. And so as I was writing about it, there were some things that occurred to me as I was writing where I was saying, like, so much of our oppression actually did have to do with splitting up Black families, right? Yeah. Like, that's kind of how it began. It's like, they said we did not have the right to our familial ties, and they tore brothers and sisters from one another, and mothers and daughters and family, you know, fathers from their children and spouses, and changed our names and, you know, all of that. And so that was one thing that occurred to me as I was writing about it. And then the other thing was the initial title of this chapter was Mixed Babies Won't Save Us. That was the initial title. And I changed it because I wanted it to be more positive and more attractive to us.
Or you could have entitled it Don't Mistake Negrophilia for Genuine Love.
Yes, because people do also, because remember the whole book, I'm trying to debunk a bunch of myths about social
violence. That you are.
And one of those myths is that if we just have sex with enough Black people, and I hate to say it, but it's one of those things that is out there, right? They're like, what you mean? I love Black people. I love Black people. I only date Black people. I have a thing for Black men, you know?
Oh my God.
Is that people really do have this idea that if we just start making enough mixed babies, then we won't have to talk about racism anymore. And so I also had to bring up the fact that even in intimate relationships, and romantic relationships, and partnerships, in marriages, in the dating scene, that anti-Blackness is often sometimes a lot easier to see, you know, in the way that people respond. So like I said in that chapter, you know, the dating scene really did, after I started going through this political awakening, who I dated started having a lot more significance too, because I started picking up on all these microaggressions.
Right.
And the way that people feel like as they get proximate to Black people, that they start to get passes to be anti-Black, started to reveal itself to me.
So how does it feel, as I let you go, my friend, how does it feel to be born again?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I feel great. You know, because I'm not tiptoeing around these landmines worried if telling the truth will, you know, set some white person off, right? Like, I never aim to offend, but I don't mind if I do, as long as I'm doing it with integrity, right?
Right.
And so a big part of that, too, is when we stop arguing with people who are really engaging in bad faith, really, right? We give ourselves space to rediscover ourselves. And I've really enjoyed reconnecting with my roots and chatting patois with my family and, you know, learning more about my ancestry and trying to discover more about that, right? Who are we apart from what white supremacy did to us? You know, that's a way more exciting question to me.
And it's important, dude. It's important. And it's important coming from you. The question, yes, but the answer, because the answer is what you spend the chapters of this book walking through. And when you get to the end, you make it very clear, not just
the catharsis of what you've expressed and how you've expressed it, but the sort of affirmation of self as a Black man.
Yes.
And I think it is one, there were a number of moments in reading that part of the book where I was thinking back on my time in public service, and I'm standing in front of young men in our prison system in Baltimore, and 13, 14-year-old boys. And I would always say to them, this is not the definition of the rest of your life, this moment, that there is another side of you that you need to find and express.
Yes.
And that struck me as what you did in this book, was you found that other side of you. Mm-hmm. And so you are now born again as a Jamaican man in America who loves both his family and his country in a way that is expressed differently than white America may see it, or white America may want it expressed. But that's the beauty of our country. We get to do that. We get to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you did. And you did in this book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, Hope and Hard Pills to Swallow about fighting for Black lives. You fight for Black lives in this book, my friend, and we really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. That means a lot to me.
It's a, folks, I'm telling you, I don't bring crap to the table here, folks. You know by now that the authors, particularly young authors that we try to highlight and bring out, is for an important purpose, an important reason, because they're telling a story you got to hear. They're telling a story that I guarantee you're going to connect to. I don't care what your skin color is. And they're telling a story that is setting us as a country on a course that we can't avoid looking at each other in dealing with some truths that we're now trying to put up and hide behind. And so Andre Henry does that. And so I thank you, brother, for taking time, man. It's really, really good. I kept you a little bit longer than you probably thought, but it was, I hope it's well worth it, was well worth it for you, because I know it was for me and hopefully for our audience.
My absolute pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You got it. All right, folks, that does it for this conversation for now, but you know, we got more coming for you. We love it when you go on Apple Podcasts and Spreaker app and download and do all those wonderful things. Certainly, we want you to go and get a copy of All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep. Follow Andre on Twitter at Andre Henry. Check it out and check out what he's doing out there. You will hear his voice on many platforms, speaking truth to power, and again, letting us know about that fight for Black lives. And so take time to learn, listen, and understand. And if you like this episode, certainly download it, share it with your friends. I love it when you comment on the Spreaker app. It makes me feel all yummy inside, and I can better do my job better as well. So until next time, be safe, be well. Oh, by the way, no more masks. Oh, my God. At least that's what they tell us until CDC comes back and say, no, y'all need to put those things back on. But right now, we free at last. Until next time, folks, take care.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us, the way Americans do, on a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news, weird politics, weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.